This podcast was made possible by a sponsorship from AveXis, a clinical stage gene therapy company. The following content was not developed by AveXis.
Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast, episode 29. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Joining us today is Kelly Miller from Houston, Texas. Kelly is a retired disability claims rep, and she has SMA type 2. She currently lives with her husband there in Houston. Kelly, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, no problem.
Awesome. Well, Kelly, to get started, so, you know, I know you through the SMA News Today forums, which to our listeners out there, if you have not joined those yet, please do. You can meet a lot of it, connect with a lot of interesting people. But I just wanted to start by talking about your background and diagnosis story. So could you talk a little bit about, you know, first off, when you were diagnosed with SMA and what it was like for you growing up with SMA just in your childhood and early in teenage years?
Yeah, I'm of the generation that was a long time ago. It was in the 60s. I was born in 1963, and I wasn't diagnosed officially until 1968 when I was five. My parents knew there was something wrong because I didn't hold up my head or turn over or crawl or pull up or any of those things that most kids do with strength. So they knew something was up. They took me to lots of doctors. I remember going to different places and having people poke and prod and do all kinds of tests. They did some kind of electrical test, which I'm told is to stimulate the muscles and see what happens to them. They also did a muscle biopsy in my thigh. I don't really remember that, but I do remember the electrical test. And they did a lot of whacking on my knee to see if I had reflexes, which, of course, I didn't, being one of the major signs of SMA. No reflexes. I remember thinking to myself, I don't even know what that feels like. Did your leg just jump or your arm just jump when they hit you in the right spot? And I felt kind of left out from being able to do that. Everybody else could do it, and everybody else, when they were at some age, would try it and be very excited that their leg would do that, but I couldn't do it. So that was what I remember from then. My parents, I was the oldest. I have a younger brother. He's 2.5 years younger, who does not have any disability. He came along really before they knew exactly what I had, and way before they knew how to test when, you know, before you were even pregnant, if you had the gene or didn't have the gene, or if they could even test for it when he was in the womb. So my parents, I guess they took a big risk not knowing what was wrong with me, but knowing that there was something. And then they had another baby. So it was just the two of us. We grew up in Jacksonville, Florida. My parents were very good, I think, about treating me just like they did my brother. They expected good grades from me. They expected me to work hard at school. My parents were of the mindset that they didn't pay for grades. So everybody else got their dollar bills, and we did not, because they said it was our job to get good grades, and we should be happy and satisfied with those because we did it ourselves. So that was what we did. I did get good grades. I was in the top of my class all through elementary school and middle school and even high school. I was in honors classes. My brother and I hung out a lot when we were young. remember him, one of the things he used to do is on Saturday mornings when cartoons would come on, he would come into my room because my parents slept late, and he would swing my legs over the bed and help me get down on the floor, and then he would drag me into the living room by my feet so that we could watch cartoons together. Of course, kids didn't have TVs in their room back then.
Right.
So we had to get to the living room, and he would sit me up and either fix us some toast or cereal. He was extremely independent and rather precocious at a very early age, which turned out to be to my benefit, obviously. It was cool. I remember thinking back how that was really cool that he did that. And I don't know how we came to that. I don't remember discussing it or him offering or what. We just did it. But I remember that he would take me with him out in the neighborhood to play with friends. They'd play baseball or kickball, and I would be first base and scorekeeper. That was fun. I would go watch them ride bikes and do tricks and stuff like that. So I felt like I was really one of the kids in the neighborhood. And my brother was definitely instrumental in helping me do that. So I would say he, along with my parents, was a big influence early on my sociability and me feeling like I was like everyone else. You know, I've heard people say, you must have worried and been upset that you couldn't play baseball or you couldn't ride bikes when everyone else could. And I thought, no, really, I wasn't. I never thought about it. It never crossed my mind to think, dang, I wish I could walk. I mean, I just couldn't. That was me. And that's just the way it was. And wishing it wasn't going to make it come true. So I figured out different ways to get involved and different ways to do things. That I have to give credit to my parents too for instilling that in me and pushing me to do things like that. I remember even in third grade, I was outside at PE at school, and my best friend was out there with me, and all the girls were racing each other, running, racing. And we were at the basketball court, which was an outdoor asphalt, and they would race from one end of the basketball court to the other. Well, my best friend said, hey, I know how we can get you to race too. I can push you. So I said, sure, let's do it. And we got up there to race this girl, and they said, go, and we tore off. Now, of course, there was no teacher right there. She was busy watching the boys do things. I guess they were acting up more. So there was no way to stop us. Well, as you know, asphalt can have dips in it and cracks and things like that. We hit one of those dips. It was a manual chair, and I flipped over and landed on my forehead, my face, planted onto the asphalt. I remember one of the men teachers coming over and scooping me up and running with me to the office, and then them calling my parents. And my dad came and got me and took me to the ER, and we got stitches in my head. And I remember my dad telling the nurse that I had fallen off. Oh, no, maybe he didn't tell them. It's just the nurse who was putting in the numbing medication. She said, what happened? Did you fall off your bike? And I thought, am I going to explain all this, or am I just going to say yes? And I just said yes. And that was kind of my first time that I might feel a little bit uncomfortable with admitting I was in a wheelchair. I'm not really sure, even to this day, what that was about, other than I remember very strongly not wanting to tell her about the wheelchair. So, and I didn't have it there with me because my dad had carried me. So I just let it go. And said, yeah. And she was like, oh, you're very brave and all that. And so it positively reinforced me for that, which I think later on that got more reinforced and made me feel insecure about my disability as I was going through teenage years and beginnings of college and stuff like that. So I think it it had an effect a little bit. I went to regular school. My parents had me mainstreamed in first grade. And for people that don't know, back in the 60s, they didn't let us go to regular school.
I was going to ask about that, too, like that and accessibility. So I'd love to hear about that. Yeah,
they didn't let us go to regular school. One, because a lot of the schools were not accessible. They had stairs between floors and stuff. But the other thing was they thought that people in wheelchairs were not as intelligent or academically able to do things. So they assumed that because we were physically disabled, that we were also mentally disabled or intellectually disabled. But my mom wasn't having that. She knew that I could do anything anybody else could do intellectually. So she fought from the very beginning. They had to send me to a elementary school away from our area. I rode a bus there with a lift. And the reason was because it was the only one that was accessible. But it also had half part of it off to the side was a wing for just disabled kids. So they put me in that initially. And then my mom just went and had a talk with the principal and my teacher and said, this is not going to work for her. She needs to be in a regular class. She really fought for it. Now, I wasn't aware at the time of how much she fought. She didn't really let me in on that. I'm not sure why. It's really interesting, but, and my mom is deceased now, so I can't ask. Yeah, she never showed it to me. She just did it. And my dad traveled a lot with his job, so it fell on my mom to do all that. About halfway through first grade, they had me going to regular school on the other wing, and this school, half day, so that I would end up at this school at the end of the day where I could catch my bus and have PE with them. So it would help me become more involved during PE. But by the end of first grade, they were done with that. My mom was done with that. And I was totally in regular school. So I didn't go to kindergarten because no kindergartens were accessible. They were all private back then, and you didn't have to go to kindergarten. So they didn't send me. My brother went, but I didn't go because it was too hard. So anyway, that's how I got in regular school, and I went all of my career for school to regular public schools.
Right. That's really fascinating about the transition to getting there. But and then once you got there, did they provide you with any kind of assistive services, be it an aide with you, or were you pretty much on your own from, you know, elementary school up?
I was on my own. This was way before. I feel like I'm talking about the Stone Age, but this was way before they did assistance or help whatsoever. If I needed to go to the bathroom, I could go over to the special wing and get one of the on-duty aides to help me. But I quickly learned that I didn't like doing that. I didn't want to ask for that help, especially from someone I didn't really know. So I just held it until I got home. And that would begin the lifetime of kidney stones and kidney problems and urinary tract infections and all of that. So, yeah, and of course I wouldn't drink anything but a couple of sips all day because I didn't want to have to pee. So I just went in the morning when I got home, I mean, before I left, and at night after I got home. It wasn't hard. I somehow had this ability to do mind over matter and train my body. So that helped. But as far as note takers or any people helping me get to my different classes once we got to the age of changing classes, I didn't have any of that. The people that helped me lift up books or grab crayons or get to another class were classmates. And it was all my arranging. I don't think the teachers knew particularly what to do with me. I won't say that generally, but there were definitely the majority didn't know what to do with me, especially in elementary school. They just didn't know how to treat me, especially when it came to like PE and doing physical things in the class. If it was up to them, they just had me sit in the corner and watch everything. And for PE, they would just have me sit in the classroom and wait. I wasn't having that. My mom, even though I didn't watch her advocate for me, obviously it rubbed off somehow because I pretty much would say when it was time to do something physical, how I was going to do it or how I was going to be involved in it to be a participant. You know, they used to play this game in the class when it was raining called Silent Speedball. And they would stand up on their chairs and throw this Nerf ball to each other. And if you dropped it, you had to sit down and you were out. I couldn't play that, obviously, but I was the scorekeeper. And I kept track of whose team won and what people were on what teams and things like that. So that was my doing, not the teachers. They really had no clue. So I do feel like I kind of taught them how things were going to be. Middle school was the same. High school was a little different. We moved to Atlanta, Georgia, and my school was an old school of three stories and a basement and no elevator. So my mom and dad went with me to the principal before I went there, and he was very excited about helping us. He wasn't putting me off. He wasn't trying to keep me in a corner or in one classroom all day or anything like that. He was willing to be forethinking and to try and work things out however I needed to. And so he arranged for student athletes my first couple of weeks, the captains of each of the teams, baseball, football, basketball, to come and carry me up and down the stairs in my chair. I loved it because these were pretty good looking guys, and they were very friendly, and they really seemed genuinely nice, and so that helped me be able to break into that crowd of people that I might not have normally been able to. You know, you have your jocks and your geeks and all that stuff. I wouldn't have been in with the jocks, I'm sure, if I hadn't met them and they hadn't helped me. And I happened to be a huge sports fan, so I was happy about it. And I went to all the games, and my senior year I was scorekeeper for the baseball team. went to all the games away and home because my dad was working from home during high school, my high school. So he was able to take me to the games and stuff. And then when I got to be a senior, my friends could all drive. And my parents were very cool about allowing my friends, certain ones, to drive our van. So I got to go with my friends without my parents there, which was also very nice. It gave me a lot more ability to be social and to engage with them in things, parties and games and just maybe going out shopping even with some of my friends without a parent hanging over us. Because, you know, when you're in high school, nobody wants that.
Oh, yes. No, my parents and I did the same thing, and it was a, you know, a huge part of me gaining more independence. And, I still do that today, and it's great. But, yeah.
Yeah, me too. My husband doesn't mind. He trusts me to figure out who can do it well. And my parents did, too. They knew that I could tell which friends would be good and responsible. So they let me figure that out.
That's great. Well, and, you know, based on all that, you know, and how you learned to be independent, you know, in your early years and in your teenage years. So let's talk a little bit about your college transition. And so you wrote in a forum post recently something really interesting about how your college handled students with disabilities. And you said that you were actually required to go be on campus during the summer before you started as a student. So that was really interesting. Could you talk about that and then just your college experience in general and how you were able to live away from home and what the experience was like?
Sure. I graduated when I was 17. I wasn't quite 18. And I had never lived away from home. I'd been to camp, Easter Seal camp, MDA camp. I'd done all that during the year. So I was used to being away as much as 2 weeks at a time. But when you go to camp, everything is geared for you and your fun and your abilities and what you need. So I didn't really know what it would be like, but I always dreamed that it would be cool to go away from home. And I applied to a lot of different schools, thinking to myself, well, we'll just work it out when the time comes. Along came a small private school called St. Andrew's Presbyterian in Laurinburg, North Carolina. They came to my high school to recruit, and they noticed me and saw that my grades were very good, and I was on the honor roll. And so they came to me and said, we have this school that is a regular college, but it also has a program for disabled people. And it is one of eight in the entire country. And this was before everything had to be accessible. So finding an accessible college wasn't going to be easy. I had applied to University of Georgia and Hollins and some other schools, but they were going to present a big problem, especially in the dorms, because there's always stairs. Well, this school, because it was one of eight in the country for disabled people, it didn't have stairs. It was all one level, like Ranch, except for a couple of dorms, both men and women, that had two stories. But obviously, I didn't need to be in those. There were other dorms that were flat and set up kind of in a square with the rooms on the outside of the square in pods and a courtyard in the middle. I looked at it. It looked cool. It was far from home. 8 hours, which was enough to be away, but not too far that I couldn't go home if I wanted for long weekends. And they had a program where somebody that was on financial aid for work study would be my roommate. And they would live with me. They would be in school also. And they would get their room and board free for helping me. So my roommate would help me get up in the morning and take a shower, go to the bathroom, get ready for the day. And then if I needed her at lunch, she would meet with me. Now, at that time, I used a joystick on my chair, and I could still feed myself and brush my teeth and everything. So I didn't really need her other than to hang out. You know, we were friends, so that was cool. But I only needed her in the morning to get up and get dressed and in the evening to get in bed. So we worked out our schedules and did that, and the rest of the day I was on my own unless we happened to meet up or something. So I made lots of friends and went to basketball games and volleyball games and soccer games and continued my love for sports. And I went there for 3 years, discovered that I wasn't doing as well as I had hoped. I played a little too much and decided that it was a lot of money that my parents were paying and I was supplementing with my SSI. So I made the decision to come back home because I knew I wasn't going to graduate in 4 years. And I transferred to Georgia State. Oh, I forgot you asked about that summer. Yeah, they required any disabled students who were coming in as freshmen to go to school for the summer school session between their high school graduation and beginning of freshman year. And we were told that that was because they wanted to make sure that physically we could handle it, that we could figure out any kinks that needed to be worked out and work on those before real college started. But they also wanted to make sure that we could cut it, you know, academically. Even though they were set up to help disabled people mixed in with regular people, they still had that attitude that maybe a disabled person might not be able to hang intellectually. So I was angry. I didn't want to spend my off summer before college going to school, especially college, because I was looking for fun.
Right.
But it turned out to be good. I took a couple of classes I got credit for. I met a lot of people who went to summer school who were very laid back and got to be friends with them. So I started freshman year already with a group of friends. And it was a lot more comfortable having done that than joining in with everyone else in September and not knowing what I'm doing or how to do it. So I think it was a very good idea for the physical part. As far as the intellectual part, everybody I knew that was in a wheelchair there was just as smart as me and had no problems with the classes. There were people, I would say I probably knew about three of them, who didn't make it because it was too much for them physically. They had never been independent at home. Their parents never encouraged them to figure out things for themselves. So any type of obstacle or difficulty that came up, they freaked out. They didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to handle it. They went looking for help all the time. They really didn't have any independence. And this was just too much. So they ended up not coming back for the semester. But you could tell which ones were going to be those and which ones weren't because from the beginning, they had troubles. So I felt bad that they couldn't do it. But just like anybody else, I mean, I keep saying regular people, but that's all I know to say.
It's all good.
Regular people have the same thing. I mean, some of them are great going away to school, and others of them have been too sheltered and don't know what to do when they get out there, so they don't go away to school. So I guess in a way it was good to see that it really was like normal. It did present a problem for me going to a college like that, because back in high school and elementary, I was the only one in a wheelchair in my classes, and even in high school at the school. There were no other kids there in wheelchairs, being three stories with no elevator. I was used to having attention and being the only one and receiving a certain position because of that, a certain standing, I guess. And when I got to this college, yeah, I didn't have that standing anymore. I wasn't the only one. And I was just like everybody else. Exactly what my parents wanted, and I thought I wanted. But it really hurt me psychologically. I got very insecure. That whole thing I said earlier about feeling insecure about being disabled, that came up. And I just, I struggled a lot with where do I fit in and how do I fit in? You know, my friends are going out, going on dates and getting engaged and talking about children. And I had this mindset that I wanted to do that, but it wasn't up to me. It was going to be up to the other person. But I still was going to do my best to make it happen. And I just went through a long period, several years, of feeling like I wasn't good enough, feeling like nobody would ever choose me for a mate or choose me for a job because I was disabled.
Are you interested in understanding gene therapy? ExploreGeneTherapy.com has helpful information about gene therapy, including its history and how it is being investigated for the treatment of genetic diseases. Visit www.exploreGeneTherapy.com.
Right, right. And I think that, you know, I appreciate you sharing that for one. And also, I think it is a common struggle for a lot of people with disabilities. No matter how independent they are, there's always that voice in the back of your head saying, oh, what if I don't get chosen for this or this? But but obviously you did go on to not only have a good career, but you are also married. So I guess since you brought it up, I want to talk about your marriage first, because I know this is something you've written about in the forums a lot, and it's something I think people with disabilities are always encouraged to hear. So can you just talk first about how you and your husband met, and then what the early days of your relationship looked like?
Well, first and foremost, I have to say, I am a person of faith. So I believe in God. And at the time, I didn't. I have recently become a Christian within the last 10 years. But before that, I was not. But I was always looking for something to have that kind of faith, and just never felt it, I guess. And, you know, part of me was like, why would God make me disabled? Why did he choose me to be in a wheelchair and nobody else? I had a lot of questions. I didn't go that route. I think that's what kind of made me struggle more with there's nobody for me. There's not going to be anybody that will want to date me or marry me, because I was putting it all on me. I was making it all something I had to do. I was very bold. And if I met someone that I thought I liked, whether, you know, he's cute or he's smart or he's funny, I pretty much asked him out. And sometimes they say yes and sometimes no. But whenever they said yes, I always felt like it was because they felt sorry for me. Right. Now, whether that's true or not, I have no idea. It can't be too true because I had lots of friends who were guys. So I ended up with even more that way, but not really anybody that was going to be long-term for the rest of my life kind of thing. And then 22 years ago, I had gone to a friend's wedding on a Saturday, and I had been her maid of honor. And this was the first time I'd ever been in a wedding as somebody in the as part of the wedding party, which was a new experience for me. But my friend was so cool and had asked me and wanted me and worked things out so I could. And I came home that night, and I was online, and this was way back in the day of the beginnings of chat rooms, so it was on AOL, I'm embarrassed to say. And no, I don't still have an AOL account. Sorry to my dad, because he does. But it was on AOL, and I was in a chat room, and I could still use my hands a little bit. They were very weak, but I could type a little bit with them. I was in a chat room. I started talking to this guy. Actually, he approached me in the chat room, started talking to me. We then went to instant messaging, and then after about 3 hours of that, and I said, I'm so tired, I can't type anymore to myself. I said, hey, would you like to talk on the phone? And he said, sure, and he called me. He was in Cincinnati, and I was in Atlanta. He called me, and that's pretty much it right there. It was love at first talk. We talked all night that night, and to those of you that are always asking, yes, I told him right away when we got on the phone that I was in a wheelchair. I told him what I had and what it did and how I was and all of that. And, you know, I had a very big debate with myself in that short time between getting off the computer and going to the phone, probably a matter of 15 minutes, a big debate in my head about should I tell him now or should I wait? We had been getting along so well for these few hours. We seemed to have a connection. He was funny. I was trying to be. It was going good. And I thought, gosh, if I tell him and he backs out on me, I'm going to feel like crap. What should I do? What should I do? And I finally just said, well, you know what? I'm going to tell him, because if he can't handle it, then I need to know that right now. I don't need to be getting way deep into this and find out 2 weeks from now that he can't deal with it. So I told him, and he was very cool about it. He didn't have any problems. He asked questions, but it was like you would ask questions about anything. If he had told me, oh, I have a short finger, you know, or a missing finger, how does that work for you? Well, he was that way. He didn't seem to have a problem with it, and we continued to talk every night that week, and at the end of the week, he was divorced and had two kids up in Cleveland, Ohio. He was supposed to have them for that weekend, but it turned out they were going to go camping with their grandparents, so he called me and he said, I'd really like to come down and visit you for the weekend. And I was like, what? And he said, yeah, I want to come visit you. I'll drive down. He's going to drive 8 hours to come see me. And I said, okay. So I thought, oh my God, my mom's going to kill me. She was a little bit weird about it, but she didn't say anything. She knew better. I was 30 years old, and I was still living with her, but yeah, she wasn't going to have any say over this. So he got off work at 5. He drove all the way to Atlanta. He was supposed to come by before he went to the hotel, and he was going to stay in a hotel. We didn't have a spare room, and I don't know this guy. He didn't show, and he didn't show. And I'm like, oh my God, it's 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, he isn't there. I'm up. I've stayed up in my chair so I can talk to him and meet him. Well, finally he calls me, like around 3, and he had gone to the hotel first. And he didn't think I'd want to see him in the middle of the night. And I'm like, oh my God, I waited for you. No, you can come over. So my mom was already in bed, and he came over, and we just sat up and talked till it was almost morning. And I thought, he needs to go to bed, and my mom doesn't need to wake up in the morning and him be here. So he was getting ready to leave, and he said, do you want me to lay you down or something? And I said, okay, because that way I wouldn't have to wake up my mom. And so he laid me down in the bed and arranged me the way I needed to be arranged for sleeping, and that was it. And we spent the rest of the weekend together, and it was time to go Sunday, and I was so sad, and I was crying, and he said, he told me after that when he took off and was going down the highway, he was crying too, because he didn't want to leave me, and he didn't know if I liked him, and just all of that. So, that was it. We went back and forth. At first, I drove back and forth because a friend of mine had also met someone online around the same time, and he lived in Louisville, Kentucky, which you pretty much have to go through to get to Cincinnati. So we went, well, not really through, but kind of. She would drive up to see her boyfriend, but she would take me up to Cincinnati in my van, and then her boyfriend would come and pick her up and bring her back to Louisville, and then we'd do it all in reverse to go home. So it was a lot of driving, but hey, you do what you do when you're in love. And when she quit dating him, it didn't work out. I decided I was going to fly by myself. I had flown a couple times when I was little, but never with a power chair and never by myself. But I did. There was only one bad incident, and it worked out. So I would go back and forth every other month because he would come on the months I didn't go up there. He would come to see me. And we decided about April of the next year that I was going to move up to Cincinnati. I had already had my job with Social Security, so I could transfer up there and start a new life. So I did that and got the okay to transfer. And we moved in together and lived together for about almost 2 years. And then got married. And then we made our way back to Atlanta. And finally, we're in Texas right now. We've been living here for 9 years.
Got it. No, that's great. And it's really interesting what you said. So the first time you met him in person, he was already helping you out. And that's something I was going to ask, too, about just, like, you know, working through your needs. And, you know, I've talked to a bunch of different couples where one person has a disability and one does not, and they have different views about, you know, do they make their significant other their full-time caregiver, or do they make it kind of a balance and have someone else help out as well? What was that like for you, determining, you know, how much your husband would help you and what those conversations were like?
So I only have one PCA before they were ever called PCAs, between college and meeting him, which was probably about 8 years. I had been on Medicaid, and they had sent people every other day. I think it was 3 times a week. That's all I qualified for. They would come and help me get in the house after work, and then they would bathe me and get me ready for bed, but not put me in bed. So when my mom got home, we would eat dinner, and then later she would put me in bed. Well, when Medicaid cut me off because I was working and was had worked enough to get Social Security disability instead of SSI, Medicaid cut me off. It was before they had 1619B and would keep you on Medicaid if you were working. So I lost my Medicaid. I put an ad in the newspaper to hire someone to come and help me the same way the Medicaid person was, 3 times a week in the afternoons. Well, the girl I hired was fantastic. She was very reliable. She was very conscientious, very responsible. And we got to be really good friends. I'm still friends with her, even though we live miles and thousands of miles apart. So when I moved to Cincinnati, I had this idea that I was going to do the same thing. I was going to get a paid person that I would solicit for and hire before I got up there, who would come in the morning and help me shower and get ready for work. And they would drive me to my job, and then they would come pick me up in the afternoon. They would alternate with another person who would do the same thing. She'd come one day, the other one come the other, so that it wasn't so much on each person. Neither of them, one of them was already on disability herself, so she didn't want to work too much and get paid too much. And the other one was a stay-at-home housewife, so she just wanted a little pocket money. So it worked out great. Well, as it turned out, and Jack was happy with it, that's my husband, as it turned out, one of them stole from us, and the other one had a nervous breakdown.
Wow.
Due to problems in her own life. And I thought, gosh, I chose so well the first time. How did I screw this up? But now that I know people are looking for PCAs, I realize that it's real easy to screw it up. And people present themselves very differently from the way they really are sometimes. And you just have to kind of take the bad with the good. But after that, both of those didn't work out, Jack was like, I would just rather do it myself than to worry that they aren't going to show up and I'm at work or school and can't help you and you're stuck. I don't want to have to do that. And it's okay, I'll just do it. And that's been the way it is ever since. I guess they were around for probably about 8 months each. They both kind of flaked out at the same time. It's worked out. I mean, I wouldn't recommend it for people because I think it puts a lot on him. I think he gets stressed and gets tired. And at the time, I didn't have a feeding tube or a suprapubic, so I didn't need as much. And I had lost use of my both arms, and was using a Sip and Puff on my chair, which I still am, obviously. That was because I got really sick one time and lost a bunch of strength and just couldn't do it anymore. But I still was not on any kind of feeding tube or breathing apparatus or anything. So I was pretty strong in that respect. I just couldn't move my arms. So he didn't want to have to deal with people not showing up. We've done that the whole time. I think it's just sometimes I think he needs a break, you know?
Right.
But it seems even when I have go out with friends or get them to do things for me, I'll come home and it's almost like he, I don't know what the word is. It's almost like he felt like he should have been the one doing it or taking care of me.
Right.
He always seems like he's not in the great mood that I thought he would be in from having a little respite. That could be me reading it wrong, or it could just be something that he isn't really used to, and so it kind of throws him off a little bit, you know?
I mean, I see that happen with, you know, parents as well when, you know, their child's primary caregiver, and then when they start, their kid starts getting outside help, it's very nerve-wracking for them because they want to be in control, and so I think it can be a very natural instinct to feel that way.
Yeah, I think he worries about the car, and what if we would break down, and all this and that, and I'm always like, okay, look, I know what I'm doing. I can handle it. I'm not going to be stupid and not know what to do. And but, you know, there's a difference between knowing it in your head for him and feeling it. So,
right.
I don't know. It may be one of those things that we just always have that, but it hasn't been bad. I mean, we have really good communication between us. So he did have to quit working because outside the home. Because I got really sick in 2014 in the winter. Horrible, horrible pneumonia. Ended up severely dehydrated and sepsis. And almost died. Became unresponsive twice in two different times.
Wow.
But that's when I ended up with the feeding tube. And so I got that. And then I needed a lot of chest therapy, percussion, and the cough assist. And I took a lot of medicine. So he really felt like he needed to be home. He ended up working from home at that point. And so he can stay with me during the day and make sure I have stuff to eat and get my medicine, and I'm okay. He's always, always worried about leaving me alone because I can't do anything. You know, I can't open the door. I can't. Recently, I couldn't do the phone. I mean, it's been so much with the Alexa and the way computer systems are now within the last probably 8 years or so, that it's become so much easier for a disabled person who can't move, essentially a quadriplegic, to be able to have communication with the outside world and get what they need in the house without another person there. So he's a little bit better about that, but he won't leave me for long periods of time. Probably a few hours is the most.
Right, right. No, I understand that. And no, it really is amazing just how many technologies have come about in the last few years and are still coming out today. It makes it our lives a whole lot easier.
Sure. I mean, with my feeding tube and the SPC, it's my whole life has been changed. I really fought the feeding tube. At one point during that illness, I was in the hospital for like 6 weeks, and probably about 2 weeks in, I was still very, very sick, and the doctor came in the room and said, okay, we've decided we're going to put a feeding tube in. Well, the only kind I'd ever had was in through the nose, and I wasn't real keen on that. But he was like, no, we'll knock you out. We'll put it in. Won't be a problem. But we also want to put one in permanently through your stomach. And I'm looking at him like, what? I never really hung out with people who were disabled. All my friends, everybody I knew, my circle of being was totally non-disabled. I quit going to MDA when I was 18 and was able to. All my doctors were regular doctors that I trained about me. I didn't really have anything to do with SMA or any of that stuff. And so I didn't know about feeding tubes. I didn't know how this was going to work. And all I could think was, it's one more thing that is going to say I'm crippled. It's one more thing that is going to make me different about everyone else, from everyone else. And I fought it. I was like, no way, I'm not doing it. So they put the nose one in, and he kept coming back. And see, I think the problem was the way he approached me also. And my husband knew. He was just sitting in the back watching this and being like shaking his head. But the doc, when he came in and told me about it, he came in like, you are going to do this. This is what we're going to do to you. Anybody that knows me knows you don't approach me like that, especially about my disability and my body. I made those decisions, and you, doctor, nobody is going to tell me what I need to do. And so when he did that, immediately I was against it, and I couldn't even see the benefits until a different doctor came in probably a week later and said, you know, if you got this, you would not have to worry about chewing so much. You wouldn't have to worry about swallowing things and getting them stuck. You wouldn't have to worry about being undernourished, which was part of the reason I had the pneumonia, was because I had been undernourished, because I was too tired to chew the food all the time. So I didn't eat. You would be able to eat whatever you wanted for taste, for consistency. You could just eat soft things, like you love mashed potatoes, you could just eat those, or you could just eat snacks, or whatever you wanted to do, because you would be getting your nutrition through the tube. And the key point, you would not have to try and swallow pills anymore. Because I was never, from a child, I could never swallow pills. I thought it was a psychological thing, and apparently my mom did too, because she wasn't happy with me for not doing it. But apparently it was a physical thing. When she said that, I thought, oh wow, that sounds pretty cool. So I said, okay, I'll try it. And it's been the most wonderful thing I've ever done. I was getting pneumonia twice a year, in the hospital pneumonia twice a year. And when I got this in 2014, I've not had one case of pneumonia ever since. So I was sold. I am sold. And I changed it out after about 2 years to a Mickey, which I absolutely love, the little miniature one that everybody seems to be having now. And I swear by it and would tell anybody, you need to do it because it's fantastic. And even if you only use it once a day for medicine, it's worth it. And you don't feel the pressure of having to eat so much and be tired. God.
Right.
And then 2 years ago, I got, maybe three now, my SPC, and that's been a life changer too. No more kidney stones, no more urinary tract infections. I pee pretty much all day in a bag and don't have to worry about how much I'm drinking or eating, and that, I'm sure, has contributed to better health as well. Fortunately, I have managed to stay away from a vent or even a BiPAP.
Interesting.
I did go to the pulmonologist last summer, and she really wanted me to use a BiPAP because my carbon dioxide levels were pretty high. And she got me one. She got me a Trilogy. And they came out and trained me and all that, and I was just going to use it at night, of course. And imagine how much better I'd feel in the morning. I wouldn't be so tired, no headaches, all that kind of stuff. Well, I didn't feel those things. I wasn't having headaches. I wasn't feeling tired. My body was adapting to not being able to do it, to get enough carbon dioxide out. But she didn't like it. And so I tried it, and I am sad to say that I wasn't able to do it. I just can't get my head wrapped around the breathing part of it. I think it's because I don't feel like I absolutely need it. So there's this part of my brain going, you don't really need to do this. You don't need to learn this. I couldn't do it. So I turned it back in, and I guess we'll have to wait until it gets bad enough that I'll need it. But so far, I haven't had breathing problems other than when I'm sick. And I do have a suction machine and a cough assist for that. But that's it. So those few advancements medically have been fantastic for me.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's more coming out every day. So thank you for sharing those. But so we are at over an hour now. It's been a great discussion, but I just want to close by asking you just what advice you have for other people with SMA or other disabilities out there, whether it's about, you know, adult life and living independently, or, you know, finding love, whatever it may be. If you could just kind of like say a few words of advice to others with SMA out there, what would it be?
First, I would speak to parents who have children that are newly diagnosed. They are so much better now at diagnosing and getting it early and finding out your child has it within the first year or whatever. And type 2, I mean, obviously it's not as bad as type 1. And I would just stress to parents that they've got to be they have to push their child to be as independent as it can be. They have to think outside the box, but not all the time for their child. Teach your child how to think outside the box. Teach your child how to look at, okay, I can't do that, but how else can I do this where I can participate? You know, show them that they can be whoever they want to be when they grow up. My mom, I wanted to be a doctor. And my mom told me all the time that I could if I wanted to. And I might be the first one to go to med school and come up with a cure and all that. And I felt no different from anyone else. So I think it's really important for parents to teach their kids, even when they have medical devices, that it's okay, that you can still be somebody. As far as the individual, for those that are already adults and maybe didn't have that from their parents, I don't think it's ever too late to become that independent person. I realize that there are obstacles financially, physically, but, you know, you never know what you can do until you try. And it's so much better to have failed than to never have tried. And a lot of times, out of those failures, we come up with a new way to do it. So I would say you just got to make yourself try everything and get people behind you for support. Get people that will lift you up and lift you up spiritually, emotionally, to help you, to boost you, to encourage and motivate you. And you'd be surprised how much that right there helps. As far as romance and relationships and things, I happen to believe that there's going to be somebody out there for you. Somebody told me a long time ago, as soon as you quit looking for him, he'll come. And it was absolutely true. When I quit trying so hard and just was me, that's when he showed up. And it was at just the right time in my life when I had already been through stuff and had worked out things within me, both emotionally and maturity-wise, and then he comes along. And so I was better able to handle that kind of relationship, both emotionally and, you know, logistically. So I think it's important to not try so hard with that, to just do what you're going to do, to put yourself in a position, whether it's online dating or go and join a group. You don't have to go to bars if you don't drink. Go to be in a club, you know, if you like photography or birds or whatever, go join a group and meet people and put yourself out there. But just put yourself out there as you, and they'll show up for you, I promise. It may not be when you think it should be, and it may not be in your timing, but I promise it will happen, and it'll be much better than if you forced it.
Absolutely. I think that's great advice, and I really thank you for sharing. Well, Kelly, I want to thank you for coming on the show today and sharing your story. This has been great. And for our listeners out there, you can connect with Kelly directly on the forums at smanewstoday.com. So, Kelly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. I'm also on Facebook under Kelly Simmons Miller. If anybody wants to hit me there, I don't mind answering anybody's questions. So, feel free. I'm always up for new friends, and I am not that person that didn't want to be around disabled people. Now, I have tons of friends that are disabled.
That's great. Absolutely. Well, for our listeners out there, you can hear more stories like this by subscribing to the SMA News Today podcast, and be sure to follow us for daily digital coverage of spinal muscular atrophy. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. Thank you for listening, and take care.
The information in our flash briefings and podcast are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. All of our podcast and flash briefings can be found on our website at www.smanewstoday.com. You can also find our podcast and flash briefings on SoundCloud, Spotify, and iTunes. And be sure to follow us on our Instagram and Facebook page as well. For SMA News Today, I'm Michael Morale, Multichannel Content Director.